This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Now, when I was a kid, food was food. For our scientific magicians, poisoned the water, polluted the soil, decimated plant and animal life. Why, in my day, you could buy meat anywhere. Eggs they had, real butter, fresh lettuce in the stores.
I know, Saul, you told me before.
How can anything survive in a climate like this? A heat wave all year long.
The greenhouse effect. Everything is burning up.
Avast me hearties, it's another edition of Radio EcoShock. Today, I'm your humble guide to mysteries of the high seas. We have guests, every one of them a leading scientist, and all agreed that ocean life is under threat, dying. On two continents, at two eminent gatherings, the research is coming in. In Monaco, environment ministers from over 100 countries received a special report from the United Nations Environment Program. It's called In Dead Water. But we'll begin in Boston at the February meeting of the American Academy for the Advancement of Science. Again, new ocean science poured out: overfishing, pollution, climate change, the last century of the coral reefs.
We really need to recognize that this is an emergency. This is code red, code blue, whatever. And if we don't start taking actions both to, as I say, help things locally and address the issue of CO2 emissions, we are not going to be very happy with the world that we pass on to our children and our grandchildren.
There are no voters, no taxpayers, no voices in the sea. But we will listen and stretch ourselves beyond our usual shores. The ocean needs our help just as we depend upon it. There is nothing simple here. What could be more complex, more fluid, more alive than the sea? The currents are changing, the species are changing, the temperature is changing. The sea we thought we knew is becoming a myth, disappearing into history. To help sort this out, we are joined by an award-winning scientist, Dr. Nancy Knowlton, currently the Sant Chair for Marine Science at the Smithsonian. Hello, Nancy.
Hello, Alex.
Well, there were a flurry of announcements about ocean science at the AAAS meeting. Why is this such a hot area of research, do you think?
Well, I think it's a hot area of research because so many different directions of research are heading in the same final destination, which is that the state of the oceans is really bad. And it's because of a whole host of factors, some of which are local and some of which are global, but they all point to really a crisis situation. And this sense of a crisis has been building, but it just came to a head, I think, at this latest AAAS meeting.
Well, there are two issues that seem sort of new to me and likely to our listeners that I'm trying to understand, and both are related to the impact of climate change on the sea life. And I'd like to start by looking at acidification. I knew this endangered billions of shell-forming organisms near the bottom of the food chain, and that's serious, but now it seems it could also create dead zones as well. Am I correct about that?
Well, acidification has its direct impacts, as you say, have to do with making it much harder for organisms to secrete their shells. But it may also just slow down their ability to grow and reproduce, even if they can sort of slowly make a skeleton. And some of these things are big, like or create big structures like corals. Others are really tiny, like little tiny members of the plankton that form the basis of food chains. So the repercussions of either eliminating or greatly reducing these shell builders from the tiniest to the largest could be quite substantial. And we actually, to be honest, we don't really know yet what the long-term consequences are going to be. This is one of the reasons there was so much energy about acidification at the meetings, was because we're just now starting to really collect information that giving us just a hint of what some of the likely consequences are going to be.
Well, what other impacts can we expect as the sea absorbs all the carbon and the excess heat from our greenhouse pollution?
Well, the CO2 has, as you say, two main effects. One is acidification, what sometimes I call the Coca-Cola ocean. Your mother may have told you not to drink too much Coca-Cola because it would dissolve away your teeth. So it's the same principle, and it, as I say, it makes makes it harder for organisms that need to build skeletons to do so. And then there's the whole issue of warming, about which people have been studying for longer, and so we have a much better handle on exactly how organisms are going to be responding. Some organisms, like corals, are in very serious danger from global warming because they live very close to the maximum temperature that they can survive. Corals have in their tissues single-celled plants that they depend on really for most or all of their food, and those plants start being unable to make food when the temperature gets above about 1 degree centigrade or 2 degrees Fahrenheit over the normal maximum for the area. And so this has led to, since the 1980s, increasingly frequent and increasingly severe episodes of what's called coral bleaching, which is when that relationship between the corals and their plant cells breaks down. Plants are evicted, and then the coral slowly starves to death, and if things don't get better, will die in the matter of a couple of months, or either directly from the heat or sometimes indirectly through disease. So those organisms are very severely affected. Then there are other organisms that might be prompted to, say, shift their ranges, and so you might get the appearance of normally equatorial species appearing in cooler waters. You might get wholesale shifts of ecosystems, including perhaps reefs, for that matter, up coasts. And the changes are so massive. When this sort of thing happened in the geological past, you get wild rearrangements of communities, and it's really difficult for scientists to predict what the total effect is going to be. What we do know is that when you radically change the physical characteristics of the ocean, you often wind up with massive extinctions, and so that is a concern as well.
Well, there's even predictions, and I guess this came out at the conference as well, that the crabs and sharks may invade the Antarctic waters for the first time for species there that have no protection against them.
That's right. I mean, this is why basically the world as you see it is used to conditions as you know it. So whenever you change the conditions, there's almost inevitably going to be reshuffling movements. Some things might do better, but a lot of things will probably do worse. And over millions of years, the ecosystem re-equilibrates and new forms of life appear. But in the short term, which is what the time frame that is of importance to people, it can be very chaotic and messy and with a lot of nasty surprises.
Well, I've heard Dr. James Lovelock saying that the seas may actually become more stable as they warm, perhaps less wave action and less circulation between the deep sea and the surface. Is that your understanding as well?
Well, this is not exactly my area of expertise. I'm really a coral reef biologist. I'm not a biological oceanographer. I know it may sound similar, but there are actually huge amounts of information in those different fields, and people tend to have a better command of their area of expertise. One thing that does seem to be coming out of the biological oceanography world, however, is the idea that the ocean will become more stratified, which is, as you say, the less mixing. And that can be bad for a number of reasons, including the productivity of the surface waters, which people depend on for food.
Well, let's pretend that a big government like the United States or China decided to act to preserve these top world fishing areas, but the budget is limited. Where would we begin? Would we go with greenhouse gas reduction or a trawling ban? Where should we concentrate our attention?
Well, I don't think it's wise to say, okay, we're going to do just this one thing. I think you need a suite of approaches, and it depends to some extent on the problem you're most interested in. I think I'll speak for coral reefs because I have a lot of expertise in coral reefs, and I would recommend for coral reefs a two-pronged approach. One is to really focus on reducing local stresses, and for coral reefs that means improving water quality and reducing overfishing, because by reducing local stresses you make reef ecosystems better able to cope with change and catastrophe. You build what's called resilience. And so it's very, very important to protect environments in such a way that they retain their resilient abilities to recover from the blows that nature inevitably gives, regardless of the role of people. On the other hand, I don't think you can ignore climate change. It's very important to remember that CO2 that we put in the atmosphere today is with us for literally centuries, 400, 500 years. And so you can't postpone that working on climate change, because every day, every week, every month, every year that you don't work to solve the problem of reducing emissions creates a problem that will last literally for centuries. So I think you do have to do both things.
What was some of the buzz at the American Academy meeting with the ocean folks? Did you hear about some other research coming that sounded interesting to you?
Well, there was so much that was going on. It's a little hard to specifically choose just a few. I did think we're starting to learn a lot more about the effects of acidification, and there's a lot of buzz about that, if you will, because our knowledge base is so small. We just don't have much of a sense of what is going to happen, and so any information is really a big improvement. And I think the other thing I think we're starting to get a better sense of, and this came out in the symposium that I was part of, but I also heard it mentioned elsewhere, is that the problem of these multiple threats, warming, acidification, and the other local threats actually have the potential to really get worse by being synergistic. And the more individual threats you place on an ecosystem in terms of stresses, the worse that they become. They multiply their negative impacts rather than just add up. And for example, one of the talks that was in our symposium talked about the double jeopardy of climate change, of warming and acidification, and that the organisms that were being studied, these little things called pteropods, which are part of the plankton, are important part of the food chain for fishes in the Arctic and Antarctic waters. These pteropods, they can continue to build their skeletons in acidic water, but they become much, much more sensitive to heat. And so, as a consequence, they can deal with one threat, but the two together is really problematic.
Is there something else you would like to tell our listeners?
Well, I guess I'd like to tell your listeners that the situation with the oceans is really grave. In coral reefs, for example, we've already lost about 80% of all the living corals in the Caribbean, and the situation in the Pacific is comparably grim, and that we really need to recognize that this is an emergency. This is code red, code blue, whatever. And if we don't start taking actions both to, as I say, help things locally and address the issue of CO2 emissions, we are not going to be very happy with the world that we pass on to our children and our grandchildren.
Well, thank you a lot for stepping up and saying that. We've been speaking with Dr. Nancy Knowlton, a well-known authority on ocean science from the Smithsonian Institute. Thank you so much, Nancy.
You're very welcome.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock on Green 960 AM, San Francisco.
They've got to tell people.
Tell them what?
The ocean's dying. Plankton's dying.
Next thing, they'll be breeding us like cattle for food. You got to tell them. You got to tell them.
Our opening clips were from the 1973 sci-fi film Soylent Green, starring Charlton Heston. Can you believe that? 1973, and Mr. NRA gets the role actually foretelling the climatic future, using the words greenhouse effect even. In more recent science, we finally have a way to look at human impacts on the whole ocean. Californian scientist Ben Halpern has the world in his laptop. Most maps show many colored countries, framed by the plain blue sea. Halpern's map is exactly the opposite. Land is the shapeless border for a map of the oceans. Each color shows the degree of impact, the amount of pollution, the damage done. What if we could see the cumulative impact of humans on the far-flung seas? Ben Halpern is a research scientist at the University of California in Santa Barbara. He's created a computer simulation that does just that. Hi, Ben.
Hi, how are you?
Well, what does your global mapping program do?
Well, what we did is we looked at 17 different human activities ranging from climate change to commercial fishing to land-based pollution to invasive species. And we took all of these different activities and layered them one on top of the other to get the big picture, sort of cumulative impact of human activities on the ocean. So in the past, people have focused on just one of these at a time. So how are humans affecting the oceans through fishing, or how are they affecting the oceans through climate change? And when you look at just one at a time, you really only get a partial picture of what's going on. So with our efforts, we wanted to get the full big picture and really understand how humans are affecting the ocean.
Well, it must be pretty complicated. I mean, you have an area where species may be weakened by, say, warmer oceans, and then you have trawlers digging up the bottom and perhaps chemicals leaking out from the coast. How can you put those together when you're doing your mapping?
That's an excellent question. We developed a very rigorous scientific method for doing exactly that, where we use ecological understanding and criteria to account for how different activities affect ecosystems differently. So, for example, nutrient runoff into coral reefs has been shown to at least potentially be a very big problem. You get algal overgrowth that kills off a lot of the corals, whereas nutrient input into, say, muddy bottoms at a river mouth probably doesn't have much of an impact. So those differences in how ecosystems respond to a particular activity are accounted for in our analysis and allow one to make these comparisons between different types of impacts in different types of ecosystems.
You know, I managed to see a copy of your video broadcast, I guess, from the deck of a boat showing the rotating Earth. One of the things that struck me was how much or how very little pristine ocean was left. Do we know how much ocean wilderness remains?
Well, what we found is that there's no single spot on the entire planet that's been untouched by human activities. So the ocean is vast, as we all know. And despite that, we've managed to affect every single spot of it. Now, that said, there are small areas that remain relatively low impacted. And so these areas probably aren't pristine, but they're probably in very good shape relative to kind of what the rest of the world looks like. And these areas, for the most part, are in the poles, in Antarctica and the Arctic. But there are small patches of these very low impact ocean.
So we could create some marine conservation areas, perhaps?
Exactly. So what's really exciting about what we've done, we think, is that it helps us understand where and how much humans are having an impact on the ocean and where this is very low. These areas, we may decide, are important to protect to keep them in good condition. But they also provide a reference point for what we might want to make the rest of the area look like through restoration or mitigation efforts for those parts of the oceans that are being heavily impacted.
Well, another thing that really stood out from the mapping is that wherever there are intensive human settlements along the coasts, the oceans are in trouble. Can you name some of the hardest hit areas?
That's exactly right. I mean, where humans are the most heavily densely populated is also where a lot of the heavy impacts are. And by far the largest, most heavily impacted places on the planet are in the North and Norwegian Seas near Great Britain and Norway, and in South and East China Seas, which are between the coasts of China and Japan and Indonesia and Malaysia. Those are the largest, most heavily impacted places, but there are stretches of very heavy impact in the northeast of the United States, in the Puget Sound area, throughout the Eastern Caribbean, near Sri Lanka and India, as well as many other places. A lot of these places are where there are very large human populations.
And we're just waking up to this. Of course, all this happens way far away where nobody sees it, and we don't understand much about it. Do you think it's fair to say we're just in our baby days of understanding how the ocean works?
Well, it really is, the last scientific frontier, at least on this planet. I mean, we do spend trillions of dollars exploring outer space, and there's a lot of value in that, but we still know so little about, especially the deep ocean, but the oceans in general. But that said, we actually know a lot as it is, certainly enough to be now aware of what we're doing to the ocean and enough to know, you know, ways that we can move forward and better protecting and managing our oceans. So I don't think that we are or should be held back by a sense of not knowing enough in terms of the need to better protect our oceans and strategies we can use to do that. But there is plenty of room for improvement in our understanding because there are lots of the ocean that we just still don't know much about.
Well, I guess part of my feeling on that comes as a member of the public. Some of these announcements come as a surprise to us because we haven't learned about it in our basic school education. It's a lot of new science that's coming at us, it seems, fairly quickly. Are you seeing a more demand for activism in scientists to get this message out? It could be a sense of impatience with studying an ecosystem that may be disappearing.
Well, I think it's not so much probably activism as just grave concern. I mean, my colleagues and I have been studying the oceans for a while, many of my colleagues much longer than me, and we have seen in our short careers the ocean ecosystems getting worse and worse, and that is alarming to us because we know what the oceans could be like if we better manage them, and we're seeing that disappear. It's also really important to note that we get a lot of the things that we like and need from the oceans. We get fishes, from fisheries. We go to the beach and enjoy swimming in the ocean. We get our water filtered through estuaries. There's a lot of services that we get from the oceans, and these services are extremely valuable. And as we degrade the ocean, the ability of the ocean to provide those services is disappearing. And that's something I think that people are just becoming aware of and realizing that it's not just for the sake of conservation and species that we need to be paying attention to the ocean. It's for the sake of our own species, of humanity, that we need to be better managing the ocean.
We almost need a Stern report for the oceans to show their economic value.
That's right, and there have been efforts to do that. It's a very challenging thing to do, but preliminary estimates put the value at hundreds of billions of dollars a year just from the oceans, and that's almost certainly conservative.
Well, as someone who attended the recent American Academy meeting in Boston, what other ocean research really struck you?
Well, there was a really interesting report that came out actually in the same issue that our map came out, talking about a dead zone that's been formed off of the coast of Oregon that's been persistent, showing up every year for the past 6 years. And these dead zones have a variety of causes, but they are often caused by nutrient runoff from land. This one in Oregon actually is, they think, caused by climate change shifting the upwelling regime. In any case, when you get these dead zones, you get really, really low levels of oxygen, which essentially kill off all of the fish and invertebrates that live in that area, and it can have disastrous effects for fisheries and other things that people care about. And these are becoming much more common and much larger around the world, these dead zones are, and they're going to continue to do so as climate change continues, and if we don't better regulate the amount of nutrients and pollutants that we put into the water. And so these are becoming a grave concern. I think the other frontier of research right now that is alarming is the consequences of ocean acidification, and there was some talk of that at the AAAS meeting in Boston. And as we put more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, it changes the acidity of the oceans. It increases the acidity, and that makes it harder for organisms that build shells to make those shells. And ultimately, if the water gets too acidic, they can no longer make their shells. And this is going to have profound impacts on not just biodiversity, but a lot of things that people care about from the oceans.
Well, I'm Alex Smith, and my guest has been Ben Halpern from the University of California.
EcoShock Radio, broadcast and podcast. Find us on the web at ecoshock.org.